Let's move now to the second part of my lecture. After 18 weeks, or 16 now weeks, on the New Testament, we're going to then move into the history of the church in the first 500 years of the church's history. And the reason for doing that, I think, is obvious, but it's another major source of our knowledge about Jesus. We're not the first people to have asked the question, who is Jesus? Just in case it hadn't occurred to you. People are asked it all the time. Maybe their answers have got something to tell us. Maybe they've been over a lot of this ground. Maybe we could learn from them. And they, in that early church, as we're going to see later, but I want to give you a feel for it now, because it's the other major source that I've had in mind all the time. Because this New Testament was written by certain people. Just as a Greek icon is painted by the Greeks. You've got to get a Greek to tell you. The Aboriginal symbol is painted there by the elders of the tribe. I mean, you've got to go and sit down there for probably 100 years and listen and feel and be there to be introduced into something that will give your eyes to see the beauty of that story, the truth that's being expressed there. You've got to be Irish to know what they're talking about when they get onto the leprechauns. I was going to say Omathorn, because Dad used to call me an Omathorn. I thought it was a nice word. I found out later from an Irishman it means an idiot. Anyhow, Dad's dead now, so I can't get back at him yet. So, so these people were living with this question, and the community that wrote the gospel and accepted that living community recognized it and interpreted it and explained it and treasured it and didn't allow people like you or me to get it out of perspective or to misunderstand it. And it was, I suppose it was okay, the Bible, the New Testament Gospels, while in the first few generations just about everyone was a Jew. Huh? I mean, at the beginnings anyhow, you can imagine all the apostles were and everyone else. And so the painting, since it's a Jewish painting basically, even though they tried to translate it into other cultures, they're painting with their own memories, and it's written in biblical language, which is the language of the Bible. While a lot of the Christians were Semite culture people, then the language and imagery of the Bible came across direct, eh? Straight. But more and more, as the world, church world, became Greek-speaking, and that makes it sound simple, there's a whole lot of cultures in that Roman Empire, but they weren't Semite. Once it went into a different world, you can see the need for other books to come up to explain it, don't you? Art critics had to come, as well as art, to explain to people of a Greek mind from Greek schooling or the Stoic schools in, say, Rome or whatever, to explain to them the meaning of these images. And, for example, here's two statements made in Alexandria. In the first one is in about the year 200, the second one is a little bit later in the 200s. Alexandria was the second largest city in the world after Rome, in the north of Egypt, as you know, the Nile Delta. And it was the largest university in the world, and in the year 200, by that time, a whole lot of them were Christian, and the leading philosophers, it was a Christian university, you could almost say. Well, I suppose that's true, that's what it was. And one of the great minds of that time was Origen. Now, Origen, Clement of Alexandria, who was just before him, and then Origen, who was his kind of pupil, they became very aware of the fact that you can't, as a Greek, come and read the Hebrew Bible straight, flat, fundamentalist, you know. You've got to realize that that's Semitic idiom, Semitic imagery, Semitic figures, to use Newman's term, and you've got to translate it into a Greek word, not just take it as it is. He says there, I think it's a good statement to be aware of, the reason why all those we've mentioned hold false opinions and make impious or ignorant assertions about God appears to be nothing else but this, says Origen, that Scripture is not understood in its spiritual sense, but is interpreted according to the bare letter. They took the letter and missed the whole thing of it. Some took it that way, the people he's talking about, because they were Jews, and was strictly, you know, living by the letter, as he saw it anyhow, rather than the spirit of their own literature. But some of them also were Greeks who quoted the Hebrew, mentally Hebrew, Greek New Testament, and took it just flat like that, as though that was its meaning, without understanding the idiom within which it was written. Here's Cyril of Alexandria, who was some 30 years later in Alexandria, says similarly in one of his homilies, the law was able to enlighten if it were understood spiritually. You know, a very vague word, but if it was understood prayerfully, if it was understood not the bare letter, as he says, but with your heart able to, inspired by the Spirit of God and in prayer, to be able to allow the meanings of it to be communicated the way we communicate with each other when we're in love. But it proved to be unprofitable to those who enriched themselves instead with the letter, namely the external appearance of illumination which they thought they possessed but did not in reality. Well, putting it really briefly, and I will come back on this, and I don't expect to remember, I just want to get a feel of it. It was the school of Alexandria, the catechetical school of Alexandria, which is going to be so important in the early church, that for the first time came to grips with this problem and tried to come to understand the spiritual or allegorical or figurative sense of Scripture. And that was clearly a good thing to do. However, as is obvious to you, once you take something away from its literal meaning and let your imagination play with it, you can go anywhere, can't you? I mean, you can just hurtle off in any direction at all over the place, with all, and you can start finding meanings all over the place, and you can go quite bizarre. You've got to have some criteria, haven't you, when you associate images, to check those images against the text, to be sure that you're not just floating around in your own psychedelic state, but are truly coming to understand the text. And it was another school, another beautiful and important school, up in Antioch. Lucian of Samosata, or Lucian of Antioch sometimes called, was the one who edited the Septuagint, which is the Greek translation of the Old Testament Bible. And he did the whole thing, the second edition. He was a brilliant scholar. He knew, he was a literary scholar, he was a linguist, and he heard all these beautiful thoughts floating up from Origen and all these blokes down in Alexandria. He thought, God, that's hopeless, it doesn't mean that at all, you know? Look at the word, mate. You know, that you can't get that meaning out of this. And he was often right. So he had to develop, and this has got to be developed, hasn't it, any scholarly work, he had to develop criteria, and he was insisting on making sure that the images and interpretations that we got could be fixed in the text. And actually those two schools back in the 3rd century, in the 200s, in the 3rd century AD, that's all that scholars are doing today. Exactly that. Trying to see the interconnection of imagery, trying to read it that way, but trying to be able to locate the interpretations by a hard-headed literary and linguistic study of the actual text in front of them. We haven't really learned anything except we're doing it pretty well today. The scholars have got a lot of facility for that now that these men back there wouldn't have had. So that was all developing, and what it was leading to, I hope this will make sense to you if I can do it rather briefly now, was the development of what we call dogma. Because the language of Scripture, as I've tried to explain to you, is experiential language, it's image language, it's heart language, it's poet language, it's drama, it's a portrait. And it speaks to the one who loves. But someone who wants to come along and say, yeah, but what about this, what about that? Someone who wants to come and grab a painting and put it under a microscope, or take a piece of music and kind of tear it to bits and kind of locate it down on a bit of paper and or put it on a computer or something, and I don't know what I'm talking about now, you can obviously tell that. I'm trying to say, someone who analyzes it without heart, without love, without faith, without belonging to the community. Anyone who comes from outside looks at us, yes, and says, but what do you mean? You know? You say that Jesus is the image of the Father. Yeah, but that could mean this, and it could mean that, and it could mean that, and it could, couldn't it? I mean, it's hard to say what does it mean. But the mind, especially the Greek mind that was trained in this, wanted to know, yeah, but what do you mean? that's what you're saying. I got the feel of what you're saying, but where do you find that? And they said, oh, but you could read. And when they went back to the text, they found the scriptural language wasn't good enough for that. It wasn't language that was designed for a clear statement to the intellect. It was language that was designed to communicate truthfully to the whole man or woman the feeling and the truth about Jesus. But when put under that kind of heavy pressure, it wasn't enough. So they had to find philosophically defined terms that located error, and Arius, one of the great heretics of the time, could use all the scripture words and mean what he meant by it, you know. And they'd say, they'd quote a text and say, oh yes, I accept that, but then he meant something. And they knew that he wasn't, what he was saying wasn't Jesus, but he was using the words. So they had to try and chisel out scientific, technical words, Greek words. No words can ever contain the truth, but they're like a railway track, I suppose, eh? They, you know, when you're off the track and when you're on it. So they could put words out that says, well, that's wrong. Isn't that the function of definitions? A definition is a fence that says, you're out of the paddock. Now, that is wrong, and so they could put negative words. It's wrong to say this of Jesus. It's wrong to say that of Jesus. When they said the words that were right, they were words that were heading in the right direction into the mystery, but they don't say it. You know, do you see what I'm trying to say? They're in the right direction, and they're gradually refining their perceptions of Jesus, but the actual words that can state who Jesus can never be found, because you just can't put those words there. But they had this struggle to try to isolate heresy, to keep the ordinary people like you and me from getting off the track and missing the real Jesus that was in their memories. And when we look at these documents too, as we will later in the year, and I have looked at them already as thoroughly as I can, and I mean thousands of hours, just to give you an idea, like I didn't just do it on the weekend, to try to check that what I'm sharing with you is authentic to those 500 years of documents. And yeah, I have read a lot of them too. What they do is what the scripture does. In a different categories now, in thoughts that are Neoplatonic philosophy thoughts, in words that are answering the questions that they were asking, which are quite strange to us. They're not the questions you and I are asking, because they're a different world. Third century Greek world in Antioch, Alexandria, is a long way from 1900s in Sydney. But historians can make the jump with a lot of hard work, and if you want to be a historian, let's do it. But I've at least tried to do it with you and want to do it in this course, because you find them doing the same thing. They insist on the reality of Jesus' human nature, and while that must seem strange to you at first glance, that's the main thing that keeps going. It's incredible to think that people, that would be the first thing to go, but it is. The earliest heresy of the church was that Jesus was not truly human. And it only seems strange till you start looking at your own consciousness. And I'm not going to examine your consciousness, and I haven't got that vision that can... But I wouldn't be surprised if your Jesus is in any way lopsided. I bet he's beautifully divine, and I bet he's only half human. That's my bet. Because that's what my Jesus was like, and everyone around me was like, and I keep finding it everywhere. Because we were brought up on Jesus. Of course, as a seminary, I knew he was God. I mean, we all were told to say that since we were naught, didn't we? So Jesus is God, no trouble. That's silly, but I mean, that's how I was. Not the trouble in the world that Jesus being God, that's easy. God didn't know it. But man, I had all kinds of trouble to get to that, and so did everyone around me, and people still have. Because that's really the whole thing, that he was really human. And it went in the end of the first century. They said, oh, he's not really human, and they made him up to some demigod. So now they keep coming back because of what Scripture said, because of the living memory they had that he really was human. And secondly, they kept coming back to the truth. They had to try and find words to say it, as we'll see, and they're the words that we eventually get up every Sunday and say in the Nicene Creed. The Nicene Creed is the goal of where I want to get you to. Because I don't want you or me to have two Jesuses in our head that never meet. The nice, lovely, warm, courageous, revolutionary, radical, prayerful Jesus of the Gospel that everyone thinks And then we get up on Sunday and we all stand up like robots and say, one in essence with the Father, and we go through these great big heap of things about Jesus, and you'd hardly know it was the same one. They're both true. We've got to get them together, or we haven't got Jesus. See what I'm trying to do? The Jesus of the Gospel is the Jesus of the Nicene Creed, but it's the Semite love words, and it's the tough Greek philosophical, argued out, chiseled out stone words of the creed. If you have to pick, go to the Gospel for God's sake. But the advantage of the creed is that it stops you and me wobbling off the truth about Jesus. And the truths they have, I've tried to put on that page for you there. They kept coming back with the fact that there's one God. That's an astonishing thing. We could spend a week and we won't. Secondly, they kept coming back with the Father. The one that Jesus prayed to as Abba is God. He is that one God. Thirdly, that Jesus is not the Father. And there are people who said he was, but the church says no. And the fourth thing, that Jesus is that one God you're talking about. Now, can you put all that together? They couldn't either, and that's the mystery. Each statement means something. Jesus is God has a meaning that you can grasp. Not fully, but it makes sense. It says something about Jesus. The Father is God says something about the Father. Jesus is not the Father says something about Jesus and the Father. There is one God says something. Take each statement separately, and while we can't comprehend them, they are meaningful statements. The mystery is when we put them together. And that will always remain a mystery, because we are dealing with incredibly mysterious things here. But the church wouldn't allow anybody to make sense of the mystery by reducing Jesus. You get it? That's the key. And you go through it again and again and again, and you look through it, and you read through Newman's book on the Arians and all the rest of it. And the fact is, the community of Jesus' disciples could not allow that or accept it, and the grandmothers and the mums and dads and kids, and right back to the apostles and right on. This incredible mystery, they couldn't let it go because it was the only way they could talk about the only Jesus they ever knew. And so my intention in this course is not to go through all those heresies again. I couldn't be bothered going through them, and I'd hope I'm not locked in them. The church has taken us a long way. I think we can learn from that. So I'm going to start from a presumption that the church is right. Is that a reasonable presumption? No, I'd like to start there. And I'd like to play now for a few moments with your mind to realise the limits of our thoughts on that, because these are the thoughts perhaps you come to a course on who is Jesus with. You know, what do you know about person? And what do you, when you think of person, when I think of person, I can only think of a person being one being and a being being one person. That's the only one I can think of. It's the only experience I've got, and it's the only experience you've got. But let me play with a few thoughts in your mind. You know, perhaps God is love. I don't know what to make of this, but God is love. Love, you know, when two people love, they sometimes said of old people that are still together, you know, those endearing young charms which I gaze on so fondly today, when the sunflower faces the sun where it sets, the same look that he gave when he rose. How's your song? Is he all right? You know the song I'm referring to. When people have grown old together in love, they're often very like each other. One gets half a thought and the other one finishes it. I've seen that and you've seen it. Love can bring a lot of union of heart, mind, soul, psyche. Is it impossible to even throw yourself to infinity and imagine that love in God could be such that two persons in love could be one being? I don't know enough about it to say it's impossible, so... And the Gospel says it's actually true. In God we know that when you think of wisdom and you think of love, you think of two different attitudes sometimes. Or we can only think bits and pieces. We analyse, and with us there are all kinds of differences. We know philosophically that in God wisdom and love are one. Justice and love are one. There's no bits and pieces in God. There can't be. It makes no sense to our mind. Could it be that in some way that's beyond my imagining, that in God the persons in God are one in being while being distinct as persons. That's what our theology says. We can't see enough to say it's not true. Maybe, and this I think is what happened, the phenomenon of Jesus, the incredible phenomenon that Jesus was, started a whole new philosophical need to come to realize how little we knew about person, about being, about substance and so on. And the Greek world, this discussion we're going to have this term, was going on. It was the heat of the... Imagine every university in Australia buzzing with this idea. Can you imagine in our secular world? Every Roman bath, they were pulling the plug out on each other over this argument about whether you could have two... You know, it was exciting stuff. It was front line of every Roman herald that came out. And it took them centuries and they're arguing about this. And there's actually even wars about it and well, but you know, that's all very sad. But we're dealing with a mind-expanding mystery that has led to those beautiful statements of what we call the Nicene Creed. My aim in this course with you is, as I've put here, not to resurrect old heresies. I'm sick and tired of reading about Arius, and too many people didn't believe him to be right for me to start playing with that idea again. I want to accept with you the convictions of the community that are there to be seen, and every scholar in the world who's gone back has found them there. We're on very solid ground here. What I want to do with you is accepting the mystery of the humanity, the divinity of Jesus, to try to get perspective in there with you, with myself, to try to help us see, well, what is actually said in the sources, so that the colours are clear, at least that. We may not be able to put them all together and comprehend the mystery, we won't be able to, but let's at least, let's not make the mystery a mishmash. Let's make the mystery the inability to get all the lines to converge, but let's see what the lines are. Huh? Let's see what they said about him, truly, and check my thoughts and your thoughts against that material. Because it's consistent and it's beautiful. And above all, as I've already perhaps indicated, I want to establish with you, and my perspective will be mainly to let the truth of Jesus' humanity come over us. Because that's the only place I can really be at home. If you want an angel to tell you about his divinity, if the angels know any more, try that. But I'll be mainly, of course, because that's what they were mainly aware of, the reality of his humanity, keeping open the mystery that didn't enable them to sum him up in human terms. They had to go further. They had to use images that went to infinity about him. To conclude now, two statements by, again, John Henry Newman that I picked up recently, one of them for my own protection and the other for the truth of what we're doing here. It's nice when you find things like this in Henry Newman, when you, like all of us, suffered a bit from this. He talks back in this is written in 1833, he talks about timid and narrow-minded men who are unwilling to receive the truth in that depth and fullness in which Scripture reveals it, and who thought that orthodoxy consisted in being at all times careful to comprehend in one phrase or formula the whole of what is believed on any article of faith. Don't know what that says to you, but it says a lot to me. The church at the moment, sadly, is rampant with people like that, who want everything to be said in every proposition, and it's got to be right. And if what's not said is presumed to be heretical, I don't know, I don't want to get too excited about this. But really, it is sad. It's insecure. It's also fairly ugly, and has little to do with portraiture or any painting. As we go through our study of Jesus, let's allow ourselves to look at him from one point of view and see the meaning of it with confidence that if we go right around, we'll get a good picture of Jesus. But don't let's want everything to be said in every formula all the time to everybody, or we'll say nothing. We won't see anything. Do you Anyhow, that mightn't mean as much to you as it does to me, but I thought, good on you, John Henry Newman. And finally, in one of his speeches on the Feast of the Holy Trinity, and this is a prayer for you and for me as we begin our course, which begins next week, may we never speak on subjects like this without awe. May we never dispute without charity. May we never inquire without a careful endeavour, with God's aid, to sanctify our knowledge and to impress it on our hearts, as well as to store it in our understandings. Lovely, isn't it?